All right. Good to see everybody. My name's Matt Williams. I'll be doing the teaching this weekend, and we're going to be in Matthew 2. So you might grab a Bible that looks like this. If you have one, like you can grab a Bible that looks like anything. If you grab one that looks like this, it'll be around 578. We're going to study together for a few minutes, and then we're going to have a chance to sing and worship, and that can become a response to what God has said, because he'll say something to us corporately, he'll say something to us individually, and then we'll have some time to sit, think, sing together, reflect, meditate, and if we accomplish that, that's what we came to do, and so that'll be a good thing. So it's good to see everybody. Before we get started, there's so many things that our church is doing that you do see, but there's so many things that you don't see. And so there is all these ministry opportunities, and there's ministry that's going on that you may not be aware of, a lot of things that I'm not even aware of. So there's ministry that you don't see. And I want to show you real quickly a slide of a class that just finished FPU, which is Financial Peace University. This constitutes a group of 9 families that went for 13 weeks. And here's the deal. At the end of 13 weeks, they have paid off $61,000, a little over $61,000. They have saved over $18,000, all right? So that's 9 families, $61,000 in debt paid off, $18,000 saved, and that's just after the 13 weeks of the course. In 3 months, those statistics jump up. They will have saved more. They will have paid off more debt. But here's what I want to tell you, is that that is movement towards freedom, so that they are freed up to be generous. They are freed up to, when they go to bed at night, just go to sleep and not worry about this debt hanging over their heads. And so we want to be an equipping church, and there's something very practical and physical about that, but there's something very spiritual about that too. And so I'm working with a young guy who just after 2 years of paying off a bunch of credit card debt just reached a huge milestone, and we are celebrating that. I'm taking him to dinner as a way to celebrate. So that goes on my credit card, right? So but we could take him to dinner to celebrate, hit this huge milestone of him paying off a bunch of debt, and it brings physical freedom, it brings spiritual freedom. It's a really good thing. And so we want to celebrate that every chance we get, and it just frees us up in so many ways. So I wanted to get that out there. All right, we are in a new series called The Arrival. We got Anna that we looked at. Ryan Donnell walked us through the story of Anna, her expectancy. What caught me that weekend, and I was hosting on Pelham Road, was the idea that if God doesn't come through for her, she looks really foolish in the way that she lives, which is a call on us, that we should live in a way that if God doesn't show up, we look ridiculous, because otherwise we're just living like the culture and the world around us. So that, I don't know what all that means, but I know it means something, and I know it caught my attention, and I know there's work to do in my soul as it responds to that. Bill talked about Joseph last weekend, that he is a consumable. You know, from the kingdom's perspective, is that God reached in and interrupted him and burdened him and invaded his life and wrecked his space and caused him to shoulder some weight. And that's not too much to ask to have your life become a consumable for the kingdom, because Jesus turns around, and we do that in a micro way. In a macro way, Jesus becomes a consumable for us, that his life is sacrificed for us to bring us eternal life. Well, this weekend, we look at Herod, the life of Herod. Now, the first 2 weeks, positive. Next week will be positive. This week, negative. I take that like my life's a consumable, right? Donnell gets the easy one. Bill gets the easy one. I take the hard one. It's fine. It's all right. I give my life up for the kingdom. It's fine. I do that, right? We're going to see Jesus through Herod's eyes in Matthew chapter 2. And Herod is going to do something for us that's an unusual gift. Is that he is going to cause us to see Jesus in a worldly sense, but take it all the way to its logical, devastating, cataclysmic, and horrible logical conclusion. And we live, many of us, live in that train of thought, but are not empowered to take it to its logical conclusion. And Herod is going to do that for us, because Jesus is, by his very nature, exposing. So I was talking to a young lady the other day who had some tests. The doctors are concerned about her. And so they gave her some dye so they could take pictures of her insides. Because you look on the outside, beautiful, talented, smart, everything looks great. But she had some dye put into her system that shows that not everything's great. Okay, there's something wrong. But that dye is so unique, and that situation so unique, that it can be exposed what's wrong, what's broken, what needs to be dealt with. And so Jesus functions like this very unique die that can not just see us on the outside, but gets on the inside of us and exposes things that are connected, things that don't belong, things that contradict, things that are hypocritical. He's going to expose us and some other folks along the way. So Matthew chapter 2, let's read together. Very fascinating story. I'm going to try to keep it under an hour and 30 minutes. All right, here we go. Chapter 2, verse 1. I hadn't taught in a couple weeks. Pen up, ready to go. All right, here we go. Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the reign of King Herod. Herod, there's a bunch of Herods. Going to get really confused. A bunch of years later, you're still going to be confused. But this is Herod the Great, okay? One of the first big ones, the Herodian dynasty. From 73 BC to 4 BC is when he reigns. Good guy? New, right? Bad guy, okay? Ahab, kind of bad guy. So we just came out of 1 Kings, so you got that. So very bad guy, does not like anybody. He has problems with every relationship in his life. He's appointed to be king, more like governor, is how we would phrase it, by the Roman Senate around 39 BC. And so his family was converted to Judaism, but no authentic Jew considers him to be authentic because of the corruption of his lifestyle. So he does not live a Jewish lifestyle. Even though he claims Judaism as a religion, he works for Rome. They would say he prostitutes himself to Rome. He will kill one of his wives because he gets frustrated with her. And so marriage counseling, no, I think I'll just kill her. Kills three of his sons because they pose a threat to his kingdom. And so it doesn't kill all his sons. The other guys are fine, but there's three of them that die in the process of being related to him. All right? So next phrase, he says this, about that time, some wise men from eastern lands arrived in Jerusalem. These are what a better term is magi, because they are related to astrology. Okay, they probably come from Persia or Babylon. And it says this, they ask this question, where is the newborn king of the Jews? We saw his star as it rose, and we have come to worship him. So these are strangers, foreigners, we would say non-Christians. You go, well, why are they concerned about Jewish king? They're concerned about all kings. They follow all religions on Twitter. They know everything that's going on. They Google every day to find out what is going on. They are checking in with this newspaper. They read all the major newspapers from the country. They are tapped into what's going on in other countries, probably because of the captivity in Babylon, where you have Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. You have that whole time where Judaism is brought in to the Babylonian kingdom. They become acquainted with Jewish God, Jewish thinking, and Jewish prophecy. So they monitor everything. So they come because you say astrologers. Yeah, so we have astrologers who are interested in the things of God. Yeah, we do. Yeah, we do. They're interested in all things of God. And so they know there's something happening with Jewish God, so we're going to go see it. We're going to go be a part of it. We're going to see what's going on. But at this point, these are not believers who come for a believing interest, which makes this story so interesting on so many levels in their ability to pursue and to worship a true God. Verse 3, King Herod was deeply disturbed when he heard this, as was everyone in Jerusalem. This is the big tension of the passage. From a literary perspective, this is it. This is the passage. This is what everything else flows out of, is that there is tension, there is a concern, and when he says deeply disturbed, there is no celebration of, we have a new king being born. Deeply disturbed for a number of reasons. Let me give you just a couple. There's a sectarian idea here. Sectarian, that within this group, there are divisions. We hear about it all the time in the Middle East. But here's where it starts, a long time ago. We have a Jewish family, okay, that God creates, Sarah and Abraham. It starts this Jewish nation. Born into that family are two sons, Jacob and Esau. Jacob and Esau do not like each other from the very beginning. Jacob has been chosen by God to receive a greater share and a more prominent role. Esau doesn't like that. Jacob is not really worthy of that role early on, and so there's all kinds of tension between these two brothers. It kind of gets settled, but not really. So those two brothers produce two nations, Edom and Israel. The book of Obadiah talks about the tension, not just between the two brothers, but between the two nations. Esau Edom, Herod is an Edomite. Jacob, Israel, Jesus is a Jew, an Israelite from the line of Jacob. The brothers don't get along. The nations don't get along. Their descendants do not get along. Edomites, Jews. It's a tough deal. So we got some sectarian tension, all right? We have political tension. You got the Herodian dynasty that is emerging. You have the Davidian dynasty. The problem with Jesus is he is a son of David, and ultimately the Jewish throne is whose throne? David's throne. So we got David's throne, and now we have a son of David who looks like an heir to the throne, which is a problem if you are Herod and you're not of the line of David, which he's not. And there's the personal piece, which is where we will get caught in the story. It's where we'll get drawn in. The personal piece is that Herod doesn't want there to be another king. Why? He likes being king. He thinks it suits him well. He loves the autonomy of getting to be king. And if you said, hey, would you rather be king? Or would you rather someone else be king? Herod goes, well, let me pray about it. I think I'd rather be king. I think I'm good at it. I think I like it. I like some of the privileges that come with it. And then the last phrase, and everyone else in Jerusalem. Why is everyone else in Jerusalem freaked out because a new king is born? We have no idea. We don't know if they're afraid of Herod, or we don't know if, you know, the idea of saying you want a king and actually God showing up and bringing you one are two different things. No idea. Verse 4. He called a meeting of the leading priests and teachers of the religious law, and he asked, where is the Messiah supposed to be born? They will quote to him from Micah 5. In Bethlehem in Judea, they said, they're quoting Micah, for this is what the prophet wrote, and you, O Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are not least among the ruling cities of Judah, for a ruler will come from you who will be a shepherd to my people Israel. So this is a prophecy that is predicted from a long time ago. It's a prophecy spoken by a prophet who's been inspired by God. So he basically says, this is what God says, and this is what God wants. What should your response be to that? If this is what God says, because this is what God wants, then you should say, oh, that's what I want. Like on my best day, that's Matt, on my best day. Hey, what's God said? What's God want? Oh, I think I want that too. That's me on my best day. Is that me every day? No. Is that you every day? No. Is that Herod every day? No, that's Herod no days. Okay, no days does Herod feel that way. But it does raise the question. It's easy to pick on him and go, isn't that interesting? Is that we have a flow of what God wants, and we have a man going, I don't want that. You go, well, why would you oppose God? It's a really good question of why he would oppose God, and we can ponder it, but the bigger question we're going to get to by the end is, why are we opposing God? Why would we stand in the way of something that God clearly wants and speaks to? So that kind of hangs out there. Verse 7, he has his own agenda. Then Herod called for a private meeting with the wise men, and he learned from them the time when the star first appeared, and then he told them. He said, go to Bethlehem and search carefully for the child, and when you find him, come back and tell me so that I can go worship him too. Okay, there's nobody, except for maybe these few men, who think that Herod is for real. Okay, hey, why don't you go find out, tell me about when all this happened, tell me what you've learned, you go find out where he is, and then come back and let me know, and I want to go worship him too. No one around him believes that that's going to happen. You can do a little research and you're looking for a star that appeared to them and you're like, when did this star appear and is it supernatural or natural? It's 8 years off of Halley's Comet, so that's not it. It's not Jupiter and Saturn that have lined up to make the star that they saw. It is, I think, supernatural. All right, so there's no natural occurrence we can tag it to, although people try to do that all the time. At the end of the day, here's where he says, when you find him, come back and tell me, because I want to go get him too. But here's the problem. That's not who Herod is. Herod's a killer. And so there was a joke by Josephus and some of the other historians of the time, is that the Greek word for hous is pig, and the Greek word for son is huios. They're spelled exactly the same except for the I that puts the little I sound, hus and huios. And when you just look at them, they look like the same word because the I kind of gets lost in it. And so the big joke was behind Herod's back is better to be a huios in the kingdom of Herod than a hus. Better to be a pig in the kingdom of Herod than a son because you got a better shot at living through his reign than you do if you were his son. So this is not a good man. And he is lying all over the place, and he is, here's the deal, He is threatened by the birth of a baby, which raises huge questions. Some kind of neurotic way of thinking. Why would he be threatened by the birth of this baby? And he's at the end of his reign. It's not like the baby, he's going to live long enough to see this baby become a man. So what has him so neurotic? Because the reality is, what should his response be? He should help install this baby as king. If this is what God's doing, and this is who the king is, then why wouldn't I just join the flow of what God is doing, help fulfill the prophecies, and help make this baby the king? Why wouldn't I just do that? But he's not going to do that. Verse 9. After this interview, the wise men went their way, and the star they had seen in the east, underline this word, guided them to Bethlehem. So even if you could explain the first star in a natural sense, you can't explain this star in a natural sense. It's supernatural. It went ahead of them, and then the star did this. It stopped over the place where the child was. And so this is supernatural GPS programmed in. Leads you there. You see, our worship leader, one of our worship leaders, Matt Kelly, and I, we had a secretary a few years ago. I won't mention her name. She just had her third child, so I'm not talking about her, right? But she programmed in the wrong addresses for a GPS that she gave us when we were traveling out of town one time and about got us killed. But I'm not talking about that. Right? I'm not going to bring it up. I'm not going to talk about her name. And in fact, she just had her third child. It's been a long span of time since I've seen her. Not talking about her, right? But this is the kind of GPS you get that you don't get lost. Fire or star is a big deal, right? So like in Israel, Israel's being led through the wilderness by fire. Fire's a big deal. The fire of God that lives in the Holy of Holies, fire's a big deal. The fire that burns up sacrifice, big deal. Day of Pentecost, fire rests on everybody's head. So probably this is some kind of star-like ball of fire that is leading God's, it's God's presence leading them to God's presence. Okay, so that's the stage, all right? That's the setting. Here's the story, verse 10. Here's what we've been waiting to get to. Verse 10, when they saw the star, they were filled with joy because something dramatic has happened. Here's what we're getting excited about. Starbucks got the new Christmas blend. Son, we so excited. What are we going to do? Amazon got this new book, got to have it. Steve Jobs, life story, got to have it. Right? But here, something really powerful has happened, and they are really excited about it. Verse 11, they entered the house, and they saw the child with his mother, Mary, and they bowed down, and they worshiped him. Now, there's really no way to get your mind around what's going on here. This is not just kind of three men walking. I think Bill touched on some of this last week. We don't know how many. Could be a bunch. But here's what we know. We know there's not three. We know that they have an entourage with them. They are powerful representatives. They are bigwigs. They are big deal. From the land they come from, they don't travel alone. They have lots of money, lots of wealth, lots of resources. They are very powerful people. And they are dressed in royal robes. And so they enter the house. And here's the thing. It's kind of redundant. The word worship means to bow down. It says they bow down and they bow down. They bow down to worship, and they bow down to worship. And so in their royal robes, with their entourage, with their wealth, with their power, they lay in the dirt with their forehead and their face leaning forward into the dirt, worshiping this baby, based off of a prophecy. Here's the thing. It is the beautiful picture of why God created wealthy people. Did God speak to the shepherds? He spoke to the shepherds. So is God in touch with poor people? God's in touch with poor people. Are poor people right in the middle of what God's doing? Absolutely, right in the middle of what God's doing. And I was reading some stuff recently and where God kind of showed me kind of this dichotomy and how it works in a fallen world. Here's the value of wealthy people. Is that when they walk in the room, you're like, look at that wealth. That's amazing. And here's what you're supposed to get from. If they're that wealthy, think about the God who made them that wealthy, how wealthy they are. And then when those wealthy people get in the dirt and bow before a holy God and worship, you're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. If wealthy people have to bow before God, I got to bow before God. If they're that wealthy, think how wealthy God is. Look at what God did to them. They were made that way because that's an overflow of who he is. And they're having to obey him. And they're having to come underneath him. It's the beautiful picture of what wealth means in our world, is that it's something that flows from God and it's still underneath his authority and it means nothing outside of a context with him. And so you have this beautiful picture of God does not leave the poor. He does not abandon the poor. They're right in the middle of what he's doing. But here's also another picture of the beauty and the value of wealth, of how it flows from God. It represents who he is. And those that are wealthy are only that way because he made them that way, and they come up underneath him. And here they are worshiping true wealth and true beauty and true power, which leads us to an intuitive definition of what it means to worship. Is that they bow down. So what do? This is really, really, you can't get any simpler than this, I don't think. Is that they are debasing one thing and exalting something else. This is as simple as it is. And this is what we're supposed to be doing in the moment of worship, but also in a lifestyle of worship, is that we're supposed to humble something, put something down, and we're supposed to elevate something and exalt something else. You can do it with anything. You can debase anything and you can exalt anything. You got to pick the right things to debase and the right things to exalt. And so we kind of have this intuitive idea. You do it when you compete. I had a big eye-opener this year. My son was a freshman in high school and ran cross-country for the first time. I showed up for my first cross-country meet, and I'm ready to pull for our team. I'm ready to pull for my son. I've never been to one. I don't know how far they're running. It's awfully hot. It's early in the morning. I don't know who runs this early in the morning. I got a bunch of questions, but not till I see what happens. As soon as everybody takes off, everybody from all the different teams is cheering for everybody, even people not on their team. I'm like, this is communism. What are we doing? One of the guys from our church has his daughter's friend. He pulls me to the side. He goes, here's what, he goes, you pull for everybody. I was like, no, I don't. No, I'll trip them and run them down, not pulling for them. He goes, no, you got to pull for everybody. Got to encourage everybody. I was like, this is going to take some time. It took about a month. Now I'm good with it. Go to cross country meet, cheer for everybody. Cheer for some people more than others, but learn how to cheer for everybody. Is that a good thing? I think so. It's a new world for me. I'm coming around, right? I get there. But it isn't, but here's what I do know. It seems to be a good thing in that world. It's not what we're doing in worship. We're cheering for one thing, and we're not just not cheering for everything else. We're actually putting down everything. It's the one place where you get to put everything else down. These men, in all their royalty and all their power and all their wealth, they put themselves down. And they exalt this king, which is what worship is. It's to debase myself, which I'm really tempted to exalt, and then to exalt a true king. Whether you're riding in the car or whether in church, music playing, sitting still, praying, reading the Bible, writing out a contract, reading the newspaper, whatever is going on in your life, whatever you're putting your hands to, whatever you're thinking about, is the opportunity to abase yourself and put yourself down and exalt something else that's more worthy. But you have to decide that this is not worthy and this is worthy, because the natural inclination is to constantly exalt myself. And that's part of the relationship between who I am and who God is. So when you see two nations, particularly in the Middle East, who will say, why can't y'all get along? Why don't y'all go meet and talk about it? And they'll be like, the one nation will say, they don't even recognize our right to exist. If you ask them, do we exist as a nation? They say, no. How can we carry on a conversation when they don't even recognize our right to exist? And you're like, oh, that's a good point. Could you recognize their right to exist? Okay, yeah, and then we'll go talk. Part of having a legitimate relationship is that you recognize appropriately who this person or who this entity is. And God says, if we're going to relate well and you're going to worship me, you're going to have to recognize the dichotomy, the disparity in who you are and who I am. He said, you're going to have to recognize that you don't belong with me. You're going to be with me because I'm going to let you be with me. But that's part of what worship is recognizing how great God is, how high, how lofty, and how low I am. And most of the problem in my life is being confused around both of those issues, that God's not really that high and I'm not really that low, and trying to bring some equity to the relationship and it doesn't belong there. And worship is about engaging exactly what they engage: their mind, their emotions, and even their energy, their will, what they give themselves to, and they're giving themselves to bowing before him. All right, next phrase. He says this. Then they opened their treasure chest and they gave him gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh, which had been picked up in church history in a beautiful way to say gold, he was a king, frankincense, we're going to worship him, which was used in worship, myrrh for embalming a dead body because he's a baby kind of born to die, right? So that's personal, that's this history and this symbolism that's really, really nice. But here's what the bigger point is that they're bringing a tangible expression of their worship to him, something that is costly. Does a baby need this? No, I mean, he could put aside for his college fund or something like that. But no, this baby Jesus, 7 pounds, whatever, has no actual need for this, but it's not for him to be able to use. It represents kind of who they are. Is that they are worshiping with their resources and they're worshiping with their money and they're worshiping with something that's very costly to them. And that actually is important too. You're like, well, why is it important? Why would you bring money to God? What can he do with it? He can't spend it, right? And so sometimes we bring money into a religious setting because we're advancing the kingdom. But this is all about the idea of worship. It is the same thing a man does in a microscopic way when he goes out and he purchases a ring and he gives it to her and says, hey, will you marry me? Does she need the ring? Can she use the ring? Does it have any real tangible? No. And you go, well, so I'm going to spend a lot to buy this ring, to give to her. Why? If I don't spend a lot, does that mean she doesn't have value? No. You can't make it walk too far. But the idea is this, is that I'm going to show you with something of value that I think you're valuable. And I'm going to show you that I think our relationship is valuable by giving you something that's valuable, that was a sacrifice to me and that was a cost to me. Now, if you get married in college like I did, you don't have much money, so it's not that much. But it was a lot to me then. And so if I bought a ring now, it would be worth more than the ring that I bought then, right? Which I borrowed like $7 from everybody I knew, right? Payback for 20 years. But what you're saying is, as much as I can, I'm trying to communicate that you're valuable through something I'm giving you that's valuable. It's not that you need it. It's an expression of what's going on in my soul, that this sacrifice is not as big as you are, that this is not as important as you are. It is sacrificial, and it speaks to something deep in my soul when I can do it. And what I have to remember, what you have to remember is, what they model for us is you have to choose to worship. Like in a moment even, let's say in a service, we're coming down the home stretch of Christmas and we're going to have a number of opportunities to worship together. And so you may raise your hands, you may kneel, you may sing, you may sit quietly, you may confess. Here's what some of us have to do. You have to learn to emote. Like I have all these emotions, but I don't really understand them like some of you do. Some of you have complete access to your emotions all the time. They make perfect sense to you. Mine don't always make sense to me. And I can harden up and be real focused on life and work and whatever. And I have to come into a moment and I have to actually peel back some callus and pull my emotions forward and go, I need to worship not just with my mind. I need to bring my emotions to this also. Because I can engage my mind and then I can go out and just be dutiful and obey. But there's a part of me that needs to be emotive and bring that with me. And you're wired up differently, so you got to bring something else. Maybe the obeying part's hard, or maybe the intellect part, maybe the mind part is hard, whatever. You choose to come worship. You choose to lay down before the King. We can also worship in life. Let me tell you what worshiping yourself is like. Instead of worshiping the King in a moment like this or in a season like this, overspending is self-exalting. Overeating is self-exalting. Yelling in anger is self-worship, right? Isolating yourself because you've been wounded, that's a form of self-worship. Self-protecting is self-worship. Crying, this is what I'm teaching in my home because we have a bunch of girls. Crying can be self-worship. Not always. I didn't say it was always. Don't send me an email. But you can make yourself the center and just melt and make everybody rally to you. It can be self-worship. We can self-worship in any way. So whether we're in a worship moment, a church service, or whether we're out serving, giving our life away, loving, how we live and how we express ourselves in a worshipful moment, all of that can either exalt ourselves or exalt God. And one has to be debased and the other one has to be exalted. Here's what's interesting. These wealthy guys, they entered, verse 11, they saw him, they bowed low and they worshiped, they opened their treasure chests, they gave him gold, frankincense, and myrrh. They do all this based off of a prophecy. It's a big deal. Because here's what we're doing. I can get busy and fast-paced. I'm not looking at a prophecy and wondering if I should worship God. I'm looking back at a cross where he laid down his life, paid a price for my sin. I mean, they have this kind of mystery about what's going to happen in the future, and I have all this clarity about what's happened in the past. What's evoked them to worship is not near as powerful as what is evoking me now. I have far more clarity than they could possibly imagine about why someone should be worshiping. Verse 12. When it was time to leave, they returned to their own country by another route, for God had warned them in a dream not to return to Herod, because that would be a bad deal for them. Incidentally, home by another way, James Taylor, in case you really want to know the Lord, there it is. You just go download it. Verse 13. After the wise men were gone, an angel of the Lord appeared to Joseph in a dream. There's not enough people in our church that get James Taylor. I just noticed that. All right, we'll work on that. Get up, flee to Egypt with the child and his mother, the angel said. Stay there until I tell you to return, because Herod is going to search for the child and kill him. That night, Joseph left for Egypt with the child and Mary, his mother, and they stayed there until Herod's death. So they're going to leave Israel. They're going to go to Egypt. They're going to wait for years till he dies, or for a season, and then they're going to come back. Okay, and it's just foretelling and prophesying that. This fulfilled what the Lord has spoken through the prophet. I called my son out of Egypt. What's he talking about? Where's that come from? Old Testament. Talking about Israel, that Israel goes down to Egypt, and God says, I hear their cries, and I will call them up out of Egypt. And now he uses language about his son, Israel, and he says, no longer is Israel my son. Now Jesus is my son. He's my true son. And so now Jesus, officially with the apostle Matthew, now takes Israel's place as God's son, which is a big deal, and here's why. Because if you were an Amorite living in the wilderness after the Exodus, and you woke up one day and you thought to yourself, I want to know who God is. I got to go somewhere on the earth and find out who God is. How would I find access to God? How would I know who God is? To whom has God revealed himself? And how would I find myself in a place where I could know, serve, love God, and spend forever with him? How would I ever do that? Then someone who had a brain would look at you and go, you better join the Israelites. The Jews in the wilderness? Yes. They have a cloud by day and a fire by night, which represents the fact that God lives with them. He redeemed them from the nation Israel, and he's taking them somewhere. And if you want to know who God is, you better get in touch with Israel. You got to join them. And now, in a very subtle, nondescript way, God says, if you want to know who God is now, this is my son. You got to join him. You want to find out who God is? You better get with him. You want to find out how to know what God thinks, what God feels, what God believes, what God wants. You want to spend eternity with him? You better get connected to my new son. Because Jesus now fulfills that role of taking God to the world and bringing the world to God. It is why Christmas is a big deal. We call it the incarnation, which just means the adding of meat. I heard Chuck Swindoll say a long time, chili con carne, chili with meat. Christmas is deity con carne. It's deity with meat. Jesus is deity with meat. It is not God in a man mode, okay? He's fully God, fully man. So he's going to wonder. He's going to be curious. We'll deal with this more next week. There are things that Jesus is not going to know that he's going to have to learn. He's going to grow in wisdom and stature. How does God grow in wisdom? God doesn't grow in wisdom because God already knows everything. But a man grows in wisdom because Jesus does not know everything. He has to read the scriptures and study and learn and pray, and God has to teach him. He has to trust God and believe God just like you do. He faces temptations like you do. He struggles like you do. He wonders. He concerns. He is concerned about things. He lives in an environment that is out of his control. And he has to make peace with the fact that either God's in control or God's not. Because what happened was, when the liberal theologians from Germany came into our seminaries in the 1900s, early 1900s, They tried to do away with the divinity of Jesus. So our fundamentalists and evangelicals in this country, to regain the divinity of Jesus, did away with the humanity of Jesus. So if you've been in church since you were a child, you have not really been taught about the humanity of Jesus. But what it means is that Jesus is really a man who lived and struggled. He just did not sin the way you sin, which means that you can do a whole lot less sinning than you do by trusting God better than you do. And he was an eligible sacrifice that went to a cross, did everything that you could not do, and took God's judgment for you and paid for your sin as a substitute for you. I mean, that is the amazing. People go, man, I don't know about Red Sea. Red Sea getting parted, creation. I mean, I don't know. Bro, that is nothing. The idea that God became a man and lived a person, you talk about a mystery. You talk about something you can't get your mind around. The Red Sea's nothing compared to this. Axe heads floating, not a big deal. This idea that God becomes a man is really a mind warper. But he goes and he dies in your place. Verse 16. Herod was furious when he realized that the wise men had outwitted him. He sent soldiers to kill all the boys in and around Bethlehem who were 2 years old and younger, which shows you we're dealing with a lot of time here, based on the wise man's report of the star's first appearance. And so this is an evil man who does an evil thing. He brings an atrocity about. The number of theologians who researched this area at this time would say we have probably a population of 300 people, not more than 800 people in the area. This murder of all these boys, two and under, at the max is about 30 young boys, all right, which is an atrocity. But relative to the day, is that because I used to be like, thousands of babies were killed here. What are we doing? How can God allow this to happen? I used to get so warped out, and it is a horrible atrocity, but it's probably less than 30, and compared to all the other things that Herod does and all the other later, it's a small atrocity, if you can even say such a thing. But it leaves you with great questions about how in the world is this kind of evil so pervasive? And what it tells me is that you have this kind of evil. We are in desperate need of a legitimate king who can come in and redeem and make this right. Verse 17. Herod's brutal action fulfilled what God has spoken through his prophet Jeremiah. A cry was heard in Ramah, weeping in great mourning. Rachel weeps for her children. This fulfills this prophecy from Jeremiah. She refuses to be comforted, for they are dead. There is evil and suffering. Here's what I would tell you. There's evil and suffering all over the world. It does not mean that that God is not alive and in control. It means that you are not in control. That's what suffering means. I hate it. We got enough of it in my family. All right, I see enough of it in our church. But it does not bring about the idea. That's a lazy and self-pitiful way to think. To think that pain and suffering actually mean that God's not in control. No, what they mean is that you're not in control and you're in need of redemption. That's what they mean. Because you wouldn't even know they were pain and suffering if there wasn't a good God to have a sense to compare it to, something deep in your soul. We talk about that more in January as we talk about the idea of eternity. But it means that we need to be people like Anna who are looking towards the future. But here's what it comes down to. Herod finds Jesus to be a threat. Baby, sweet little baby Jesus, 7 pounds, 4 ounces. Right? I know. You watch Ricky Bobby, you keep up with me. The autonomy, self-law of Herod, he wants a few things. See if this sounds familiar. He wants to be able to rule himself. He's not want another king ruling him. He does not want anything to threaten what he has worked so hard for. His status, his money, his power, his prominence. He has a sinful lifestyle that I'll not ruin the Christmas spirit by detailing. The dynasty of Herod is corrupt sexually. And so he has this corrupt lifestyle that he does not want someone leaning in and saying, that's wrong, you're going to have to abandon that lifestyle. And your family is wrong, and you're going to have to abandon your family for allegiance to a new king. And here's what we would do, is that we would in this moment distance ourselves from him and say, he killed 20 babies. He's an evil man. He lives in an immoral way that I would never live. Let me just say something. It is arrogant to say that. The same stuff that drives him is the same stuff that drives you. The only difference is you live in a culture where you do not have the freedom and the power that he has. You do not know what it would be like if you were a dictator, who from the time you were born, you were told that you're not only human, you're also divine. And these other people are human, and some of them are not even human. But you have subhuman, you have human, and you are human divine, and you're human divine. And anything you want is your right and your privilege, and everything else in the world exists to serve you and take care of you. I mean, do you really think all the dictators in South America and Southeast Asia, do you really think they're that much different than you, that they're a different breed of people? Except that the major difference is they were told something for a long period of time that now they believed. So what they do makes sense. We really can't create two stratas of humans. Then what we're doing is the same thing he's doing. We're saying these people who are dictators, who kill other people, they're subhuman. We're really humans. There's something different about us on the inside. And what I would tell you is there's really nothing. Is that we have been restrained in a way that they have not. Our own culture, historically, how we have treated people. These people count as people. These people do not count as people. When we write our own documents, all men are created equal. Ironically enough, the people writing those documents have slaves that say that they're not equal. I mean, we have this in our own, it's just a very short history. All right, so let's don't say that we're so different when on the inside, the very instincts are exactly the same. And so here's the reality. Herod has thought through the position logically for us. Because here's what's true about me and true about you. And we'll say it's in a lesser way. Is that I don't want anybody else ruling me. My instincts are I want to be self-ruled. I don't want to be ruled by anybody else. The idea of a new king entering into my world is very threatening. And I am desperately worried about what he might have in mind for me. Because he may not have in mind for me what I have in mind for me, because I have a lot in mind for me. And I have big dreams and big visions, and he may not have that in mind for me. And so he's a threat to me. If I think through it logically, he is a threat to me, and he might, listen now, especially for folks that are new, Jesus might make my life a consumable. He may not make my greatest dreams and wishes come true. He might have another path and my life might become consumable. And oddly enough, there's a pattern of him doing that. Interrupting Joseph's life and making his life a consumable. Something that got used up for the kingdom. He might interrupt my status and my influence and my resources. He might ask me to live a different kind of life and hang with a different kind of people and invest in this group of people that I normally wouldn't have anything to do with. He might move me into a place that I would never move on my own. This king might really be frustrated with the fact that I nurture all this sin that no one else sees. That I have this sin in my mind, I have this sin in a closet, I have this attitude, I have this that I participate in, and he may not like that. And I nurture it, but he may expose it, and he may call me away from it. And I may not be able to please him without abandoning what I so preciously care about and what I so work so hard to nurture. And he might even call me to a whole different way of living. And we have some folks in our church who would say, I'm really struggling to follow Jesus because what does that mean for my family? What does that mean about my mom and my dad? If I say I believe this and they don't believe that, what does that mean for them? I'd have to redefine all of my history and my family and where I come from. And this king might ask you to do that. So the baby in the manger raises huge questions. And Herod, as dark as he is, and exactly the opposite of Joseph as he is, actually does some thinking for us and moves us along a path logically that we may not go on our own. And so here's what I tell you. If you're new to our church or you're new to the faith or you're thinking about big questions, you're asking big questions, the battle that you feel waging in your soul is this, is who gets to be king? You get to be king or Jesus gets to be king? And I am sorry that our culture and our churches have pitched to you, sweet baby Jesus wants to bring you presents down the chimney. That's what Jesus does. And not just little presents, big presents. Pray, get him into your heart, and he'll bring you big job, great wife, wonderful kids, lots of money. That's what you do. You pray to him, he'll give you all that. That's what it means to follow Jesus. I would tell you that is not true. You cannot control him or manage him like that because he's a legitimate king. And here's where we are as believers, for all of us. In this moment and in this season, we have to choose to worship him, which means I have to lower myself and I have to exalt him. Because Christmas is about a bunch of rich folks putting their face in the dirt and worshiping a true king and reminding themselves, everything in me thinks I'm a king, but I'm not a king. Let's pray and we'll worship. Lord, we're asking that we could make some of those words true about us, that I could make some of them true about me. As that as powerful as I want to be and would like to be, that I could abandon myself and abandon my kingdom and my kingship and my desire to rule, and that I could lay before you and kneel before you and raise my hands before you and sit and contemplate before you, that I could dig into my own emotions, into my own mind, direct my own energy towards you to abase myself and exalt you. That is a work that no man, no woman can do on our own. And so we need you to lead us. We need you to open us up to ourselves. We need you to help us see ourselves as we truly are, the areas where we don't even see it as self-worship and self-exaltation, where we don't even see the fact that we're cutting you out of our lives because you are a threat to us. And so, Father, would you help us to see you as not a threat, but as one who has our best interest at heart and wants to give us life? We ask it in your name.